Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The U.S. Justice Department says it has opened a federal hate crimes investigation into the fatal mass shooting late Wednesday at an historic African-American church in the southeastern U.S. city of Charleston, South Carolina. The suspect, 21-year-old Dylan Storm Roof, a white male, has been caught and is in police custody near Charlotte, North Carolina. Charleston Police Chief Greg Mullen told reporters Thursday Roof walked into Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church during a weekly prayer meeting and sat with the churchgoers for at least an hour before he then opened fire. Several others were wounded in the massacre. 3 men, 6 women were killed in the shooting. Pope Francis called on the world Thursday to combat global warming to prevent environmental ruin to the earth. In a landmark letter, the pontiff supported scientific evidence that climate change is mostly caused by human activity, that, he said, could, this century, lead to an unprecedented destruction of ecosystems. Francis said a massive political and economic transformation is needed to replace, without delay, the world's dependence on highly polluting fossil fuels that lead to climate-changing global warming. The head of the UN's Commission of Inquiry on Syria said Thursday that Syria is at a bitter and murderous stalemate as countries with the ability to push toward a political solution to the country's 4-year war fuel the fighting rather than work for peace. In an opinion article in The Guardian, Paulo Pinheiro highlights the human toll of a conflict that has sent 4 million refugees fleeing the country, pushed another 7.6 million from their homes within Syria, and seen schools and hospitals destroyed. This is VOA News. The world is facing the worst refugee crisis in modern times, and the global response has been pitifully inadequate. This, according to the latest annual report from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Humanitarian groups are calling for a global summit to address the crisis. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Exhausted, sunburned, dehydrated, and carrying nothing but a bag of clothes, Syrian refugees Sami, his son and his wife, limp across the dockside in Catania, Italy. They and hundreds of others were rescued this week from rubber dinghies in the Mediterranean Sea. Every human on this planet loves their country, Sami says, but the situation in Syria would force anyone to look for safe shelter and a safe country for themselves, for their wife, for their children. The UN says that by the end of 2014, more than 60 million people were forced to flee their homes, the biggest displacement of the human race ever recorded. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Hong Kong lawmakers have overwhelmingly rejected a controversial Beijing-backed electoral reform package that had divided the territory's opposition and pro-government forces. Camps of pro-democracy protesters erupted in cheers Thursday after opposition lawmakers united to defeat the bill. Just 8 lawmakers voted for the legislation, while 28 voted against it. China, which formulated the reform proposal, reacted negatively to the news. The death toll from South Korea's MERS outbreak has risen to 23, according to officials, a day after the United Nations said incompetence had led to the spread of the virus. South Korea's health ministry also said Thursday that they have confirmed 3 more cases of the Middle East respiratory syndrome. Seoul officials insist the disease has peaked and is largely contained to medical facilities, but concerns are still mounting over what the largest MERS outbreak outside the Middle East is. Economic reports published Thursday show the U.S. job market getting stronger, inflation rising slightly, and the strong dollar hurting American exports. The low level of layoffs suggests that employers are confident the economy will rebound from the slump it hit in the first few months of this year. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Refugee Agency says worldwide displacement from wars, conflict, and persecution is at the highest level ever recorded, and it's getting worse.
That's VOA's Jody Capua reporting. Details coming up.
Also, Human Rights Watch has charged Libya's Council of Deputies in the port city of Tobruk with rampant torture in its prisons. And President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle send Ramadan greetings to the world's 1.6 billion Muslims today.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Liberia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN Refugee Agency says worldwide displacement from wars, conflict, and persecution is at the highest level ever recorded, and it's getting worse. The UNHCR has released its annual Global Trends report, which says nearly 60 million people were forcibly displaced at the end of 2014. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The UNHCR describes the level of displacement as a dangerous new era that dwarfs anything seen before. Spokesman Babar Balouche explains.
It's really a sad reality of the world that we are living in today. I mean, last year in 2014, there were 59.5 million people that were forced out of their homes, either as internally displaced people, or they were forced to leave their countries and cross an international border, or they needed to seek asylum somewhere.
He says the figure is 8.3 million higher than at the end of 2013.
This is a staggering escalation in terms of people being uprooted every year. What we are talking about right now is 42,000 people are being forced out of homes every day.
The Global Trends report, entitled World at War, says that in region after region, the number of refugees and internally displaced people is on the rise. It says in the past 5 years, at least 15 conflicts have erupted or reignited. Eight of them are in Africa, three in the Middle East, one in Europe, and three in Asia. Balouch says one country has been the main driver of the upward trend since 2011.
The highest numbers that we are seeing in terms of people that are displaced is the Syrian Arab Republic. So with that, we have 15 million people that are affected in Syria and Iraq with that. And Syria today is the highest refugee-producing country with the conflict now entering its fifth year almost.
Some 7.6 million Syrians are displaced within the country. About 3.9 million are refugees in neighboring countries and elsewhere. Afghanistan, which has suffered over three decades of conflict, is the number two producer of refugees, with nearly 2.6 million. Hundreds of thousands are displaced within the country. Afghanistan is followed by Somalia, producing more than 1 million refugees.
Adding to that, you have new conflicts. Ukraine was there last year that started. We now have Yemen as a new conflict. Things are heating up in Iraq again. South Sudan, Central African Republic, and Burundi is the new one. So there seems to be no end to the conflicts that the world is dealing with.
Balouch says donor aid is not keeping pace with the rising number of conflicts.
The resources that we humanitarians have are getting limited and limited. How are we going to deal with the millions when the resources are just not there? Last year, UNHCR asked for over $6 billion to deal with the refugee crises around the world, and we got half of it.
He says aid should also be given to countries shouldering the refugee burden as hosts, such as Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, Ethiopia, and others. The UNHCR spokesman highlights problems contributing to displacement.
There needs to be political will to find solution for these conflicts. Number two is we humanitarians have reached a point where we just are not able to clear the mess that the global politics is creating today. So if we are supposed to take care of these poor people, women and children that have suffered too much, we need to have resources. Number three, countries need to keep their borders open for these people.
He says half the world's displaced are under age 18. Many are minors, separated from their families. Gang violence and persecution in Central America are causing many people to flee there. The United States saw nearly 37,000 more asylum claims last year than it did in 2013. That's a 44% increase.
As a humanitarian organization, we are asking countries to do the right thing that we as human beings have signed up to. Human beings are in need of protection and they're desperate and they need to save their lives. They should be given protection.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, says we are witnessing a paradigm change, an unchecked slide into an era in which the scale of global forced displacement, as well as the response required, is dwarfing anything seen before. He adds that it is terrifying that there is more and more impunity for those starting conflicts and a seeming utter inability of the international community to work together to stop wars and build and preserve peace. In related news, the Institute for Economics and Peace says 180,000 people died in conflict last year, while deaths from terrorism numbered 20,000. It says war, homicides, violent and sexual crimes cost the global economy over $14 trillion in the past year. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Human Rights Watch has charged Libya's Council of Deputies in the port city of Tobruk with the rampant torture in its prisons. The Tobruk regime in eastern Libya is the internationally recognized government in a country torn apart by rival militant groups and two competing governments. HRW investigators say they interviewed more than 70 detainees held in Benghazi and Baida. The detainees said they were physically tortured and deprived of medical care and visits by family members. The report also quoted Libyan officials who acknowledged the country's justice system had collapsed. The council in Tobruk has also rebuffed efforts by special UN envoy to Libya, Bernardino Leon, to share power with their political rival, the General National Congress, which now occupies the historic capital, Tripoli. The General National Congress is supported by Libya Dawn, a coalition of Islamists and militants from the west of the country. The UN Security Council yesterday repeated the power-sharing request in a meeting in New York. The UN has expressed concern about the inability of Libya to police its Mediterranean coast, where smugglers are sending thousands of migrants to European shores.
Chad officials report a series of bombing attacks today on Boko Haram camps across the border in Nigeria and arrested five suspects in the Monday suicide bombings in N'Djamena, the capital. As Chad reported its counteroffensive in Nigeria, survivors of attacks last night on two villages in southern Niger report more than 30 dead. Militants on motorcycles drove through the villages near the Nigerian border, setting fire to homes in which many residents burned to death. In N'Djamena, Colonel Azam Bermondoa says today's airstrikes by Chad were in retaliation for the twin suicide attacks in N'Djamena. The government has reported 34 were killed and more than 100 people injured in the attacks on a central police station and a police school in the capital. Bermondoa claims Chad's wave of bombings resulted in serious damage to six militant bases, but offered no details. He said defense and security forces will continue to hunt down without mercy terrorists without faith or law who wage violence. No one has taken claimed responsibility for Monday's bombings.
Chad officials have also drafted plans to heighten national security. Those plans include a ban on wearing or selling of religious apparel, such as turbans and head-to-toe burqas. Prime Minister Kalazobi Fami Dubet met with religious leaders to discuss the restrictions. Chad is mostly Muslim country. Nigeria has been criticized for failing to stop the six-year homegrown insurgency of Boko Haram that has taken the lives of thousands. Chad has become a major force in the recently formed five-country command designed to end the Boko Haram occupation of parts of three states in northeast Nigeria. The Chadian capital serves as headquarters for the region's anti-Boko Haram campaign. President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria recently discussed new coordinated military efforts with leaders of Chad, Niger, Cameroon, and Benin.
A batch of local gin killed about 70 people in southern Nigeria earlier this month, prompting a nationwide ban on drinking the beverage. But producers and imbibers of the popular drink say the ban threatens not just a beverage, but a lifestyle. Chris Stein reports with Hilary Oguru in Agwagbe, Nigeria.
It's called Ogogoro, and Nigerians were sipping it decades before the mass-produced lagers commonly found in Nigeria's bars came on the scene. Ogogoro is made from palm sap, often in backwoods distilleries far from the eyes of the governmental bodies that are supposed to regulate the brew. But after about 70 died from drinking Ogogoro earlier this month in the Southern Rivers State, and another 20 died in April in Ondo State in the Southwest, Nigeria's food and drugs regulator banned the consumption of Ogogoro. That has rankled Rosalind Esaviaka, who says she uses the beverage not to get drunk, but as a way of healing.
If I have sickness, you will leave, and I don't have money to go to hospital, and they give me a native medicine, and I'm supposed to use Ogogoro, should I wait for federal government to come and give me help before I cure myself? I cannot wait.
At a distillery in the creekside village of Akwagbe in the southern Delta state, Samuel Ogrebe was carrying on a family tradition of distilling Ogogoro until the recent ban. He says he only uses materials approved by the Food and Drug Authorities to make his gin. He blamed distillers who added methanol to their mix to increase its potency for the recent deaths.
I prefer that the federal government should look into this thing because real Ogogoro does not kill. It does not affect anybody. But this certain that they use to distill this Ogogoro way, we do not understand it.
Ogrebe learned the business from his parents and is now the chairman of a major distillers union in Delta State. He says if the government does not lift the ban, he's effectively out of work.
If we leave it, what will we do? Can the federal government assist us with money to help us to finance another business? If they can do, then we can find a way to stop it. But this is our own, this we brought up on it, and our children are brought up on it. So therefore, how can it, it's impossible to stop.
Ogrebe stands behind his product. The 67-year-old says he drinks some every morning for his health. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
The UN's peacekeeping chief expressed his frustration with South Sudan's leaders yesterday, saying President Salva Kiir and his government have denied repeated requests for the UN mission there to use equipment needed to protect civilians. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the United Nations.
Hervé Ledsous laid out to the UN Security Council the problems that his 12,000 troops, police, and civilian personnel in South Sudan have been experiencing because of the government's ongoing lack of cooperation.
I see a country, and I can be very candid, that country is South Sudan, a country where we felt that we needed to do a better job to protect civilians, we needed attack helicopters, request denied. We needed UAVs, request denied by the president to me personally three times last year.
Ledsous said the mission's movements have also been restricted. Also troubling, the South Sudan government is finding new ways to harass and intimidate mission personnel.
Juba did declare some of our senior personnel persona non grata. If you look at the fact that yesterday it was announced that from now on, UN personnel who are taking pictures will be considered as spies, well, I think this raises a number of concerns.
Among the senior staff in South Sudan who were recently told they were no longer welcome was Toby Lanzer, the deputy head of mission and the UN's humanitarian coordinator. The government accused him of being outspoken about the economic and humanitarian situation in the country, where 4.6 million people face severe food insecurity and more than 2 million have been displaced from their homes and villages. For over a year, the UN has been sheltering more than 100,000 civilians who have sought protection at hastily set up camps inside UN bases in some of the worst affected areas. The civilians are fleeing fighting that ignited after a political rivalry between President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar escalated into open conflict in December 2013. Tens of thousands have died since, and the two men have not heeded international warnings to adhere to a ceasefire deal made in January 2014 and start working towards a transitional government. The UN Secretary General held a special high-level meeting on the crisis on the sidelines of the annual UN meetings in New York last September. President Kiir, who was in town, snubbed the gathering by not showing up. The UN Security Council has repeatedly threatened the spoilers with sanctions and dangled the possibility of an arms embargo, but has so far only set up the legal mechanism for imposing sanctions. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
President Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle, have sent Ramadan greetings to the world's 1.6 billion Muslims today. The president calls the celebration a time in which families and communities can come together for prayer and celebration. Ramadan acknowledges the month in 622 AD when the Holy Book of Islam, the Quran, was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. Muslims who observe Ramadan obey fasting, one of the five pillars of Islam, and do not eat or drink during daylight hours. The date of the celebration is based on the arrival of Hijra, the ninth month of the lunar calendar. The exact date when Ramadan begins is based on the first sighting of the crescent moon.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Carter Center has announced it's expanding its river blindness elimination program in Nigeria. The announcement was made at a recent press conference in Atlanta held by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and Nigerian businessman and philanthropist Sir Emeka Ofor. They said the expansion will boost efforts to eliminate the disease in Africa. It will also illustrate how the face of philanthropy is changing to include more African philanthropists. River blindness is one of the world's leading causes of preventable blindness. It is a parasitic infection that causes intense itching, skin discoloration, and rashes. In addition, the socioeconomic impact is enormous as it greatly reduces a person's ability to learn and to work. It is spread by bites of infected black flies that breed in rapidly flowing rivers. Nigeria is the world's most river blindness endemic country, with nearly all of its 36 states affected. Former President Jimmy Carter said the Carter Center has been working worldwide to eliminate river blindness.
Well, as you know, about 28 years ago, Merck and Company found out that a dog medicine they had, it prevents heartworms in dogs, but also prevent people going blind with onchocerciasis. So they came to the Carter Center and began to give us free medicine then. And so we've been using that free medicine, Mectazan, they call it. Ivermectin is a generic name. And we've treated how many, about 200 million people since then, but primarily to control the disease, because you had to give it medicine every year and it just kept them from going blind, but it didn't get rid of the microfilaria, microscopic worms. And so in Latin America, we decided to try a different tact by giving two or more doses of medicine every year. And we found that we could actually eliminate the disease completely. We could kill the adult worms that bred the microfilaria. So we are trying now to implement the same policy in Africa.
Carter said at first they did not think it was possible to end river blindness, but they discovered that by giving multiple doses of treatment every year, the disease could be eliminated. Initial tests were conducted in Uganda and South Sudan.
They have 17 districts in Uganda, and we have eliminated, completed the disease from 15 out of 17 cases districts. And we've had the same success in northern Sudan. So we hope that in Nigeria, with Sir Emeka being in kind of our leading spokesperson there, that we can inspire the people to give it 2 doses a year, which we think will eliminate the disease. So until we began multiple doses each year, we never did have a chance to get rid of the disease.
Carter explained that in the past, a big challenge in eradicating the disease is cutting through red tape to gain access to the drug that is used to treat river blindness.
We've had a problem in the past. Merck Company makes the medicine available to us. We've had a problem with the World Health Organization in the past because sometimes it takes 7 or 8 months for the bureaucracy of the World Health Organization to actually get the pills that we need to the countries involved. And in Nigeria, in past years, I've had to go and meet with the president themselves because sometimes the customs would hold up the medicine, which we wanted to get to the States, but it would be held up at the ports of entry. And I've had to go to sometimes to 3 different presidents and get them to call their customs officials to let the medicine go through. So I think we sort of make this influence now and a dedication of the major health organizations in Nigeria, we'll have a much more rapid delivery of the medicine.
Carter emphasized that a partnership with a non-governmental organization will help to elevate their river blindness program to a higher level of awareness. This was the idea behind partnering with Sir Emeka Ofor, a philanthropist who established the nonprofit Sir Emeka Ofor Foundation in Nigeria. Carter says Emeka can use his influence to help educate and treat more people in an effort to end river blindness in Nigeria.
Well, Sir Emeka has been already deeply involved in his own home state of Anambra. He knows the problem there, and I think with his endorsement of this program and his financing of a large portion of it, I don't think there'll be nearly as much problem as the Carter Center has had in the past. A lot of our problems in reaching out to the local people will be resolved by Sir Emeka's endorsement of the whole effort. So in every case when we've eliminated any worm in other places around the world, we've had the local community get involved. Sometimes it takes us 10 to 15 years to get all the communities involved. But I think in this case, with Sir Emeka's involvement, that 10 to 15 years will be abbreviated dramatically and get rid of it much quicker than it would have otherwise. Not even talking about his financial contributions, I'm talking about his personal commitment to the problem.
That was former President Jimmy Carter speaking in Atlanta at the Carter Center on the expansion of activities to expedite the elimination of river blindness in Nigeria.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Refugee Agency says worldwide displacement from wars, conflict, and persecution is at the highest level ever. Human Rights Watch charges Libya's Council of Deputies in the port city of Tobruk with rampant torture in its prisons. And U.S. President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle send Ramadan greetings to the world's 1.6 billion Muslims today. Coming up, we'll have music from Liberia and in our feature segment, positive results for an experimental Ebola vaccine known as RVS-V-Zebov. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off with Cameroon women's football.
Kim, Cameroonian football fans are celebrating their national team reaching the round of 16 at the Women's World Cup in Canada. In the capital, Yaoundé, fans cheered, sang, and danced after Cameroon defeated Switzerland 2-1 in Edmonton, Canada, to advance to the knockout stage in their debut appearance at the premier women's football competition. The indomitable Lionesses of Cameroon will next play the Steel Roses of China on Saturday, also in Edmonton. Robert Muma is one of the Cameroonian fans in Yaoundé who is closely following the indomitable Lionesses in their maiden World Cup appearance. Robert says he hopes the team's strong performance will help develop the women's game in Cameroon.
From the information we are getting back home here in Cameroon is that those girls have not even gotten their prim. But I was very impressed when I heard the captain the other day over the radio. She talked of, you know, playing with that patriotism. And I believe they're not out for money. But what I want to tell the authorities is that they should watch out for what these girls are doing and beware that when these girls come back, they should do something to improve the female football championship in Cameroon.
Cameroon was one of the highest scoring teams during the group stage at this seventh Women's World Cup. The indomitable Lionesses scored 9 goals. Only Switzerland with 11 goals and Germany with 15 scored more. Of course, a good chunk of Cameroon's goals came in their opening match when they routed Ecuador 6-0. Striker Gael Nganamouite had a hat trick in that match. Gael described her 3 goals as a lovely birthday present since she celebrated her 23rd birthday the following day. And speaking of celebrations, check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page at facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see a wonderful photo of another Cameroonian striker, Jeanette Yango, celebrating with fans at Commonwealth Stadium in Edmonton. One of the fans is leaning over the railing and hugging Jeanette, and the other fans are smiling and clearly enjoying the success of the Cameroonian ladies. Let's take a look at the other round of 16 matchups at the Women's World Cup. Before Cameroon plays China on Saturday, Sweden will go against 2-time world champion Germany. On Sunday, there are 3 knockout matches. Brazil will play Australia, France will face South Korea, and Canada will host Switzerland. On Monday, there are 2 more games. Norway will play England, and Colombia will challenge the 2-time world champion, United States. And the final round of 16 matches scheduled for Tuesday, the Netherlands will meet reigning world champion, Japan. The quarterfinals are scheduled for June 26th and June 27th, the semifinals for June 30th and July 1st, and the Women's World Cup final will be July 5th in Vancouver, Canada.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on!
Game on, VOA sports fans. Our African football guru, David Legg, has been looking at the recent 2017 Nations Cup qualifiers played across the continent. There were 25 matches in total, spanning 13 qualifying groups. In Group F, Morocco, playing at home in Agadir, edged North African rival Libya 1-0. And the Cape Verde Islands trounced visiting Sao Tome and Principe 7-1. How about your thoughts on Group F, David?
You know that old cliche, Sonny, football is a funny game. If you think about it, Cape Verde in three matches at the 2015 Cup of Nations, they could only score one goal, and that ultimately cost them a place in the quarterfinals. And now they come up against a fellow island state, Sao Tome e Principe, and they hammer in seven. And it started as early as the 11th minute when Giannini scored the first goal. And the goal avalanche continued until the 75th minute when Tavares scored the seventh goal. For the record, Leal, after 54 minutes, scored the only Sao Tome goal. Let's not read too much into this result, Sonny, because there are 150 places of a gap between these two countries on the world rankings. But nevertheless, an encouraging start for Cape Verde. Well, if there were eight goals in Praia, there was just one in Agador. It came 6 minutes after halftime, Al-Kadouri scoring. The two teams are out in front, Cape Verde and Morocco, with 3 points each. I would expect those two to battle it out for top spot. And at the moment, of course, the Cape Verdeans well ahead because of that plus six goal difference. In the second round of matches in early September, Libya will host Cape Verde, although barring a miracle, that match is not going to be played in Tripoli. It's going to have to be played elsewhere, possibly in Tunisia. And Sao Tome, at least this time, will have the advantage of playing at home, but they will be up against formidable opponents in Morocco.
In Group G, David, Nigeria, playing at home in Kaduna, defeats Chad 2-0. And Egypt tops visiting Tanzania 3-0 in Alexandria. Your thoughts on Group G, David?
This, of course, Sonny, is one of the two groups of death. We'll get to the other one later. You've got Egypt and Nigeria. Both failed to qualify for 2015. Nigeria, three-time champions. Egypt, record seven-time champions. Nigeria winning in 2013, failing to qualify in 2015. It's been even worse for the Egyptians. They won three consecutive titles between 2006 and 2010. And then, unbelievably, really, if you think of the history of African football, they failed to qualify for three consecutive tournaments, something that's never, ever happened to the Pharaohs before. So to say that the Pharaohs are desperate to qualify this time, I think is probably, Sonny, a contender for understatement of the year. And they got off to a good start. Three goals within 10 minutes in the second half, giving them a comfortable victory over a Tanzanian side who were going down to their fifth consecutive defeat. So no surprise there. The Nigerians, they found it going tough against Chad. No goals in the first half, and then Salami and Ikhalo from the penalty spot with 10 minutes left, giving the Super Eagles what I would say is a satisfactory start. Nothing spectacular, but nevertheless, a 2-0 victory. So Nigeria and Egypt level, 3 points each. And in the next set of games, the Egyptians will visit Chad, and the Nigerians will visit Tanzania. Now, my hunch with this group, Sonny, is that whoever doesn't top the group will want to win the other four games and get 12 points. There are going to be two places reserved for the best runners-up, and I think what Stephen Keshi and Hector Cooper, the coaches of Nigeria and Egypt, are probably thinking of privately, they'll never admit it publicly, that at the very worst, scenario as Z is make sure we get 12 points. In other words, beat Chad and beat Tanzania home and away. So if the worst comes to the worst and we don't win the group, we will go through as one of the best runners-up. But certainly, Group G, one to watch, Sonny.
We'll watch that group closely, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. And David will be back on my 30-minute show on Friday at 17:30 UTC with more Nations Cup qualifying analysis.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Golf news now on the VOA. The best players in the world are teeing off today, Thursday, for the first round of the U.S. Open at the Chambers Bay Course in the northwestern U.S. state of Washington. Martin Keimer of Germany will look to replicate his dominant performance from last year when he posted the top score in each round and won the tournament by an amazing 8 strokes. Keimer will have to hold off the advances of Northern Ireland's world number one Rory McIlroy and American Jordan Spieth, who is ranked number two, as well as aging greats such as Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson. Woods' stock as the world's best golfer has dropped lately, as his world ranking has plummeted to 195, and he's struggled mightily at major tournaments over the last year. Tiger will be looking to turn that around and regain the form that won him 3 U.S. Opens from 2000 to 2008. A large South African contingent will also be present in Washington with 9 players competing, led by 2-time U.S. Open champions Ernie Els and Retief Goosen. The course at Chambers Bay has been described as difficult and erratic, so don't be surprised if this tournament features high scores and frequent lead changes. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, positive results for an experimental Ebola vaccine. And next, making a motorcycle from scrap metal and an old engine in Uganda. But first, some music. Here is Imba Burr of Liberia with Ekan Dorba. Maver of Liberia with a Kandorba.
Well, in Kenya, initial results are in for phase one trials of an experimental Ebola vaccine known as RVSV-ZEBOV. The results show the vaccine is safe and generates an immune response against the deadly Ebola virus. Lenny Ruvaga has the story.
30-year-old Munga Mochiro goes about his daily duties in a matter-of-fact manner. He's an occupational health nurse and has been working at the KEMRI Wellcome Trust Research Program in Kilifi for the last 2 years. His job includes safety preparedness and visiting patients in nearby villages. And he's one of 40 volunteers participating in the Phase 1 Ebola vaccine trials. Today, Mochiro is drawing up plans to visit the villages. 5 months ago, he was given the experimental Ebola vaccine as part of a process to prepare for its use in Kenya when necessary. He says he's participating in the trials to help humanity find a cure.
Due to the fear of Ebola and misconceptions about it, and I being a healthcare practitioner, I thought it was a great thing to assist in finding a solution to this epidemic.
Trials of RVSV-ZEBOV began last December in Kilifi and three other sites in Switzerland, Germany and Gabon. Scientists at the Canadian National Microbiology Laboratory developed the experimental Ebola vaccine, which was cleared for clinical trials last year by the World Health Organization. Dr. Patricia Njuguna, a clinical researcher and pediatrician, is the lead scientist tasked with developing the phase one trials in Kenya. For the last 8 years, she has been involved in various vaccine trials for other diseases, including malaria. The Ebola epidemic broke out in Guinea more than a year ago and spread to Liberia and Sierra Leone, killing more than 11,000 people. Dr. Njuguna says the positive results from the participants in Kenya could herald new insights into the search for a cure.
The participant is vaccinated and the immune system picks up the vaccine as a foreign component in the body. It breaks it down into little pieces and the immune system develops antibodies to the vaccine. And this is what we measure to see that you're responding to the vaccine.
Liberia was recently declared Ebola-free, but a rise in new cases in Guinea has led to fears that the virus could re-emerge. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News.
Motorcycle repair has become a successful business for Roland Kayonda of central Uganda. VOA's Paul Ndiho discovered that Kayonda can even make a motorcycle from scrap metal and an old engine.
In the Mukono district of central Uganda, Ronald Kayondo thrives on repairing motorcycles or boda bodas. He discovered his love for motorcycles when he was just a young boy. By his own admission, he says that he is not a mechanic by training, nor does he claim to know much about mechanical engineering. But his love and passion for motorcycles has inspired him to build from scratch a motorized bike.
Of this machine. You see, every time you push it, you see?
How did you do this? Where did you get this from?
It was an idea that my friend and I thought about. We looked for some scrap metal and an old motorcycle engine and an old bicycle that we could use for this experiment. Our goal was to see if we could turn this bike into a motorized bicycle. One evening, we decided to take all the parts to a welder that welded everything together. We took our motorized bike for a test drive, and that's how people got to know about us.
Kayondo hopes that to use this low-cost motorized bike as an alternative to walking, long distances from work and elsewhere. Since his innovation hit the streets, he has become somewhat of a celebrity, and he's always surrounded by a group of young people. Martin Muganzi, founder of the Youth at Work Initiative, a local NGO that scouts for talent and innovations around the district, says that Kayondo and his friends are doing incredible things.
These young people are amazing. They've made a motorized bicycle. And this motorized bicycle is for all the people, the farmers in the villages and the rural areas that cannot afford the big motorcycle.
Kayondo uses his motorcycle repair skills to be creative and build his prototypes using information he finds on the internet. He built the motorized bike using local materials such as scrap metal and discarded parts from motorcycles.
What I need more than anything else is to get help in terms of professional training and funding so that I can do a lot of other things.
Finding funding for his project is difficult, but he hopes to take his innovation to the local innovation competition. Kato Joseph, a border taxi operator in Seta, has known Kayondo since he was a young boy. He says that his ability to create stuff and inspire other young people is undeniable.
Kayondo is an interesting young man, and he is an inspiration to many of these young people. He is a gifted person and reaches out to many young people who are also doing extraordinary things.
Although Kayondo's motorized bike isn't quite ready to hit the streets yet, he believes that with the right support and training, he can become one of Uganda's best self-taught innovators. Tech analysts in Uganda say his achievement is great, but it will take him years to perfect his prototype and to have it on the market.
That was Paul Ndiho reporting on a motorcycle repairman in central Uganda. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next on VOA Editorial, I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is all well and good to have legal guarantees of human rights, including freedoms of speech, assembly, and religion. But without the legal institutions to enforce such rights in the communities where most people live, these rights rarely become reality, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski. In many African countries, access to justice is hampered by too few courts and legal professionals, too long a distance between communities and institutions of justice, too little knowledge about the content of the law, and by corruption that breeds distrust of the justice system. Mali, for instance, has 300 lawyers for a population of 15 million. The majority of them live in Bamako, so despite laws providing for free legal aid, if you're a poor person up country, you don't have much of a chance to get it. That's why the United States is supporting the African Center for Justice and Mobile Courts. The interconnectedness of the world means that even people in remote and impoverished areas have a greater sense of their rights. A case in point is a widow and mother of three young girls in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. After her husband's death, her in-laws threw her and her children out of their home. The mother found her way to a legal aid clinic that was able to point her toward Congolese laws supporting equal treatment of male and female children. And with the clinic's help, she and her daughters were able to return to their home. Access to justice doesn't just mean access to courts, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski. It means access to information and to government services from a government that is responsive to their needs. And the most responsive governments are those that are freely elected by citizens and that respect term limits in office. The United States wants to see systems of governance and justice that focus on citizens and that work for and empower the poorest people in society. This is the right thing to do. It's also the smart thing to do if you want to build stable, peaceful, prosperous, and just societies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.